For more than a year, ominous rumors had been privately circulating among high-level Western leaders that the Soviet Union had been at work on what was darkly hinted to be the ultimate weapon, a doomsday device. What they were building, no one could say.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Well, boys, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies.
A Podbean backer review, chosen by Clark Fisher.
Jolly good idea. I'll keep some men on their toes.
Hosted by Arnie.
This man is obviously a psychotic.
Well, I'd like to hold off judgment on a thing like that, sir, until all the facts are in.
Stuart.
Women sense my power, but I do deny them my essence.
And Jacob.
This thing turns out to be half as important as I figured it just might be. I'd say that you're all in line for some important promotions and personal citations when this thing's over with.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
A decision is being made. There will be only one course of action open. Total commitment.
Listener discretion is advised.
Let's get this thing on the hump. We got some flying to do.
Today we're discussing Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, starring Peter Sellers, George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, Keenan Wynn, Slim Pickens, Tracy Reed, directed by Stanley Kubrick. This is the Now Playing co-host, who you can obviously sense my power and seek my life essence, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, or the co-host who will never allow a podcast gap with the Russians.
Indeed. The Russians probably aren't as regular as we are during this period of Corona, as it's a Friday, and here is another bonus Now Playing for you guys, our patrons. Thank you so much.
Indeed, another patron pick. One of you paid some money to hear about this almost 60-year-old war film. Clark Fisher, thank you.
Thank you, Clark. And why did he pick this?
Yeah, this is his second pick. He also did Forbidden Planet, so he really sends us back in time a bit.
He likes some old movies, then.
A little anti-Soviet flair in both, sure. But why this one?
He says that he enjoys the over-the-top ballsiness about a comedy on thermonuclear war, and he's a former Air Force officer. He says, as such, he appreciates the movie's beautiful cynicism, is his words. So God knows it's one of the most highly regarded films of all time, so I think Clark is probably not alone. I hear this mentioned up there with Citizen Kane when people talk about best films ever.
Yeah, I think it's probably in the top 20 shortlist of, most beloved films. Not by all, but I think we're going to talk about that. But I've always liked it. You know, I was introduced to it young. I shouldn't say I always liked it. My dad was a big Stanley Kubrick fan, and it took some time for me to grow into it. When I first saw it, I think I saw it double feature with Blazing Saddles, and I'm like, who is this Slim Pickens? I don't get him.
That's a double bill I wouldn't have picked.
Well, they're both kind of these crass comedies, and I don't think I had the sophistication enough to get any of the jokes. I mean, I didn't know anything about the world, westerns, or, we were kids of the 80s, and it should be said, while it was not the era of duck and cover, we did live in fear of nuclear annihilation. I do remember having many vivid memories and feelings about what would happen when Gorby or Reagan finally hit that red button.
Oh, I remember you telling me on the playground how if something happened to Reagan, we were dead because Bush had an itchy trigger finger, and you knew if Bush got the presidential seat, he'd just hit that button. That gave me nightmares.
Nothing was funny about it in grade school. I think I had to come to this movie in high school. Like, it helps that my mom, who is not a fan of this movie, also loves dark humor. She is a nurse, and I don't know if you know many people in that profession, but it tends to be a trait for mental health that they learn to laugh about darkness. And I do feel like I got from both my parents an appreciation to laugh at things that maybe some people don't think are very funny. And by the time I saw this again, when I was thinking about film as a career late in high school, it connected very well. It felt like probably the first political satire I could ever really love.
Yeah, I kind of already had that morose sense of humor by the time I was in high school. This one was recommended to me by my government teacher, actually, in high school. I'd seen A Clockwork Orange. Okay, that was a Kubrick film. I didn't really, like, dive into what is a Kubrick and what has he made, but she saw when I turned in my papers, I did have this dark sense of humor. I liked satire when it came to politics. I thought that was an effective way to really get at the heart of it. And she's like, oh, you need to see Dr. Strangelove. And so, yeah, I went out and I found that film and I got a lot of it when I was in high school. I get a lot more of the perversion and jokes in it now. Like, to me, that was just a dark comedy making fun of the US and Russia during the Cold War. Now I do see a lot more in it. So, that, yeah, as you get older, it tends to morph.
And 3 for 3 on having a dark sense of humor. In case any listeners ever want to call me out for some morbid black gallows corona humor, I was the son of a doctor and a nurse, and yeah, I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral and did just a few weeks ago.
But you weren't a big fan of this film, as I recall. I think, did I bring this movie to you?
I mean, you didn't bring it to me as in, here's something I'd never heard of. Dr. Strangelove was something that was often referenced, and if my memory is correct, either my senior year of high school or my freshman year of college, you and I had a movie day, and this was one you picked, and I was game because I was like, oh, I finally get to see this film everybody's been talking about. And I wasn't a fan. I remember having a very stark reaction compared to all of the accolades I'd heard, and of course, this is the unimpeachable Stanley Kubrick that we're reviewing here. I've discussed my thoughts on him overall and the pillar film people put him on and my opinion of that in general. But a lot of my skepticism of him comes down to Dr. Strangelove and Lolita. When I first saw this, I really didn't enjoy it. I didn't see what others got out of it. What was amusing to me is then I was forced to watch this about once a year, every year after the first time I saw it, because I was taking a lot of film classes, and God knows my professors loved this movie, and I would have to write papers about it or be forced to watch it in class every year, freshman, sophomore, junior. I got out of it senior year because I graduated early, but 3 years in a row, I had to watch this for classes too. And each time I got more and more angry about it, and I've never looked back until Clark donated the amount. And I'm like, all right, well, here we go. It's been a lot of time. Will I have a different viewpoint about this film in my 40s than I did in my teens? God knows I have different opinions about a lot of other things.
I mean, I think that's a safe bet. And I was having the same feeling on the flip side. I was thinking, yeah, it's been several decades since I've seen this. Will I like it as much? I mean, my memory was the satirical elements, the broad humor, the Nazi impersonations, that was the stuff that loomed large. I couldn't remember how over the top this movie was. And so I was a little afraid that maybe I wasn't going to like it as much. Maybe I would take it off a pedestal.
See, that was the stuff I remembered and hated back then.
We're talking about black comedy. It wasn't always going to be that way. The source novel was playing it totally straight. If you picked up a copy of Red Alert in 1958, not a joke in the thing. I just read it a couple days ago, and it is without any sense of even irony. It is a straightforward tale, exactly as this movie presents, except there is no Strangelove character, and the ending ends a little bit different. There's no doomsday device as well, but it is about someone that goes rogue, sends bombers towards the Soviet Union to take out sites. One loses air contact. What's agreed upon ultimately with the premier and the president is if they drop that bomb, we have to let the commies bomb one of our cities. And the president says yes to that, thinking he can get Atlantic City cleared out. He's like, I'll give you Atlantic City. You could dig that one out, thinking it would take them a while to fly over and drop a bomb, that they'd have at least 6 hours in order to prepare that city for nuclear annihilation. They didn't know, and many people didn't know in 1958, that the bomb had moved to subs, that there were now nuclear U-boats and subs that could fire missiles. It was a developing technology, and the twist ending was, nope, you don't have time. The bomb gets dropped in the Soviet Union. They're about to fire it at America, and the only reason why we talk them out of it is it turns out that the plane crashed. They didn't drop the bomb. It crashed, and thus the nuclear reaction didn't happen. So it was an explosion, but not a nuclear explosion, and Russia goes, okay, But otherwise, that story that we're here to talk about today was presented completely poker face straight on the page in 1958, and Kubrick wanted to film it exactly that way when he optioned it in 1961.
You know, offering up Atlantic City, that seems like a good bargain for anything these days, right?
I think. I don't know. Trump wouldn't do that. He's got a casino there still, doesn't he?
I think it went under. It actually was his kind of Waterloo, so he might actually be okay with that.
Yeah, it just I always think of it and Reno as the armpits of the world.
Well, yeah, be that as it may, I can say I honestly don't wish any city to get nuclear annihilated, and you've got to think that in 1961, this stuff is on everyone's mind. I mean, this is, the bomb scare was real. I mean, the climate that this movie came out in, Khrushchev had just come to power. He had met with JFK. He had banged his shoe, said, "I don't like you." The Berlin Wall went up. We tried to invade Cuba and got, you know, our asses handed to us. They bring the nukes to Cuba. We have 13 days where we think, yeah, someone is going to fire a nuke and all of life is going to die. I don't think we've ever been closer to world annihilation than that Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, when this movie goes into pre-production.
I have to ask about the novel, though. One of the, in my mind, least funny jokes about this movie actually had me look up this book, because I can't imagine in a straight book any of this is the same. But the names of the characters in Dr. Strangelove, like President Merkin Muffley.
Or Jack D. Ripper.
Yeah, Jack D. Ripper. I don't know if many of our listeners know what a Merkin is. I don't think they're in use much anymore. They're basically a toupee for your private parts that prostitutes used to use after having to shave them because of lice. And so that's what a Merkin is, and often a vagina is referenced as a muff. So Merkin Muffley, Jack D. Ripper, Major King Kong. None of that's in the book, right?
No, yeah, you couldn't play it straight and have those kinds of names. Those names came into being when Terry Southern came on board. Who's Terry Southern? Well, he was a hippie that had a hit novel called Candy. It was made into a movie. It was a real trippy. It was one of the first movies to really feel like a now 60s hippie film. He would go on to write Easy Rider, which is, I think, the definitive hippie film of all time. And so all of that sensibility is really his. Like, he really, even the typeface that we see the titling done in, was the handwriting of him. He brought that aesthetic. He was meant to interview Kubrick for Lolita. Lolita was the black comedy that Kubrick had just finished. He was acting as a journalist for a magazine, and they hit it off so well that he was like, well, you know, I've been working on the script, take a crack at it. And it just kind of morphed into Dr. Strangelove and Far Away from Red Alert.
Yeah, I'd never even heard of Red Alert. I never paid attention to the credits of this movie until this watching. It was only when I sat down to watch it for this review that I noticed in the opening credits it mentioned a book called Red Alert. And it sounds like this is really a mostly original tale here.
No, absolutely. That's what I'm telling you. It's absolutely not. It's the same story, except they've inserted Strangelove, the character, and changed the names.
Well, the Doomsday Machine, to me, changes everything.
There is a Doomsday Machine in the book, but it's not, it's got to be man. Someone's got to make the decision to launch it.
Right. It's not exactly the same thing. Like I said, it comes down to this chess game of which city are you willing to sacrifice if your screw-up doesn't get overturned. And just want to point out, this is not the first movie to even suggest making a Cold War nuclear annihilation comedy. No less than Charlie Chaplin was going to do it. He was going to take the little tramp to post-apocalyptic America after it all had been nuked. It was going to be one of his last films, but of course he was communist blacklisted and it just didn't come about. But in the 50s, he was pioneering that comedy. They were going to do it a decade before Dr. Strangelove.
You laugh like it couldn't happen or like it would be in poor taste, but The Great Dictator was a huge risk when he did it, but because America hadn't been involved in World War II, it was a way of Chaplin pushing that agenda as well as being entertaining, and it worked very well. So if anybody could pull that off, Chaplin could.
Yeah, no, I'm not making fun. I'm just laughing at the idea of the movie, of this movie coming out a decade before in the Eisenhower era from someone like Chaplin, who again ended up being unfairly run out of town. It's a sad ending to his career. I would have loved to have seen that movie, quite frankly. But I'm also glad that Kubrick met Terry Southern and they decided, let's take this to London because we really don't want the U.S. military mucking around with this. This is a Columbia picture, but shot over in England in Shepperton because there were people in the Kennedy administration that wanted to see the script, wanted to know what they were doing. We were actually very unnerved when they saw the film and saw how much information Kubrick had gotten that right about procedures, the blueprints for the B-52 bombers, all of this stuff, it's not fiction. He researched it extensively, and a lot of what you're seeing is nonfiction. Now, the caveat Columbia Pictures had for this movie, the one thing that they said, okay, you made a sex comedy out of Lolita, that was risky, but it worked. The reason why it worked, you cast Peter Sellers. He was a big star, and he was in My House. I knew Peter Sellers from Pink Panther movies like that. Our family loved those. We would go to the movie theaters in the 70s to see them. They're some of my earliest movie theater memories.
Stuart, that's where I guess we depart, because yes, I knew a Peter Sellers from Pink Panther. That's why I didn't like him. There was other films he had done that I liked him in, but I think of Detective Clouseau. No, thank you.
Yeah, I remember just, I was way too young again, but watching Peter Sellers in a Pink Panther movie and upset the Pink Panther I knew was only in the opening credits.
Yeah, there's no Pink Panther in that movie.
Okay. All right. Yes. Fraud. I guess, yes, the little V thought that that was a little bit unfair that he got cut out of the film. But no, our family recounted jokes and whole pratfalls. We love Sellers, but I didn't know any of his work prior to this. I still really don't. I'm not that familiar with his 50s improvisation stuff, where he did a lot of movies where he played multiple characters. That was his shtick. He was known for impersonations. And so he was always playing four or five different people in a movie, and Columbia Pictures said, Kubrick, you have to do that. Kubrick didn't want to, and he didn't want Sellers. He was like, what? I don't like being told what to do. You have to do it, or no funding for you. And so that was the happy compromise that I can't imagine this movie if it wasn't a Peter Sellers movie, and if it didn't have Sellers playing. Well, it was supposed to be four parts. He was actually supposed to play the Slim Pickens role as well.
Was Kubrick back then? Because Sellers was in Lolita, right? And he came back. Most people, I don't think, would work with Kubrick twice. Of the Kubrick I know from his reputation of beating up Scatman Crothers on The Shining and just the years and years he spent with Tom Cruise in Eyes Wide Shut, I can't imagine too many actors are lining up to go through this level of abuse again. Was he this bad back then?
I think Sterling Hayden, Peter Sellers, and Kirk Douglas are the only people that ever worked with Kubrick twice. Jack Nicholson famously said, you only work with that fucker once. And I think what happened is, the legend is, to look at Kubrick's career in the 50s, he went from being a still photographer for magazines into making independent noir and war films. And then Kirk Douglas, star of one of those war films, probably one of Kubrick's best films, Paths of Glory, said, come help me on Spartacus. The movie's falling apart. He stepped in as a substitute director, became known as a Hollywood guy at that point, even though that really wasn't even his movie. And one of the first things he wanted to make right after that was a Western called One-Eyed Jacks with Marlon Brando. Now, Marlon Brando is a famous asshole on set, and apparently Kubrick learned a lot about being an asshole from Brando. Brando got him fired from that movie because Brando wanted to direct it himself. And people will tell you Kubrick became Kubrick because he tried to make One-Eyed Jacks, and when he couldn't, he made Lolita, then came this movie, and then all of the controversy and success that followed did kind of make him sort of a rarefied auteur. And so powerful, he could say, uh-oh, stop this movie. One of the things that dogs seemingly almost every Kubrick project is that somebody is coming up with a copycat project. I'm going to make a Vietnam War film. Oliver Stone's coming in with Platoon. I'm going to make a Holocaust film in the 90s. Spielberg comes in with Schindler's List. This happened here with Dr. Strangelove. And Kubrick insisted, Columbia Pictures, if you're going to make Failsafe, you're going to release it after my movie. Have you guys ever seen Failsafe?
No.
Oh, yeah. It's a Sidney Lumet movie. Came out same year based on a book that actually got sued because it was considered plagiarism of Red Alert. It's the same damn movie without jokes. You can't believe it. It's got the same stark black and white cinematography. In so many ways, you're just like, what am I watching? It feels like outtakes from Strangelove. And so, again, it was a real race of who was going to get there first. Kubrick put his foot down. Kubrick was Kubrick, as you put it, Arnie. And I think he just said, look, you're going to have to put this thing out in October. My movie's coming out in January. Consequently, Strangelove gets 4 Oscar nominations. Failsafe gets no Oscar nominations, but some people will tell you it's the better film. George Clooney is one of them. He ended up remaking Failsafe for television and saying it's harder to play it straight than play it as comedy. It's a good film. I invite people to go see Failsafe, but I'm not going to say it's better than this.
So Arnie, give us a plot. What are we going to talk about with Dr. Strangelove?
Sterling Hayden plays insane Air Force General Jack Ripper. Paranoid about Soviet attack and infiltration, Ripper has ordered the nuclear bomb-carrying B-52s at his command to attack their pre-designated Russian targets. He gives them Attack Plan R, which states the Russians have already attacked the U.S., the president is killed, and only Ripper himself can cancel that order, and then only with a code that only he knows. Peter Sellers plays Group Captain Lionel Mandrake, a British officer stationed at Ripper's base. Mandrake tries to play along with Ripper's insanity, all the while trying to get the code that can be used to stop the nuclear attack. In the Pentagon War Room, President Merkin Muffley, also played by Peter Sellers, is briefed on the situation by Air Force General Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott. The president orders the army to storm Ripper's base and try to stop the bombers, but as there's only a couple hours before the bombers reach their targets, Muffley also reaches out to the Russian premier to explain this is not an authorized attack. The president even helps the premier by giving him information on all the planes and their targets, hoping the Russian military can shoot them down before they drop their bombs. But the Russians had recently developed a doomsday machine. If any nuclear bomb detonates inside the Soviet Union, the doomsday machine will automatically detonate underground bombs with enough radiation to kill all life on Earth. And the doomsday machine is built in such a way that any attempt to disarm it will also set it off. The army eventually breaks through the airbase defenses, and Ripper, fearing he'd give up the code, commits suicide. But Mandrake has deciphered Ripper's code based on his insane ramblings about peace on Earth, and with this code, the bombers are recalled, all but one. The B-52, piloted by Slim Pickens' character Major Kong, had been damaged by Russian attacks. Their communication system was down, so they couldn't hear the order to abort the attack. The plane's bomb bay doors are damaged, so Kong goes down to get them open. They do while he's sitting atop one of the nuclear bombs, and he yells yee-haw as he rides it down and it explodes. In the Pentagon War Room, the generals and president prepare for the extinction of life on Earth, but the president's scientific advisor, former Nazi Dr. Strangelove, again played by Peter Sellers, suggests several hundred thousand people can survive in deep underground mines where the radiation cannot penetrate. These people would be able to repopulate the planet after about 100 years, when the surface of the Earth is no longer inhabitable. As the government plans that, we see the doomsday machine go off and several nuclear explosions shown as credits roll, sort of. I mean, this is the 60s. The credits were really at the beginning, but as the movie ends...
Guys, we should feel safe. We're told at the beginning of the movie that none of this can happen, right?
Yeah, that was insistence. Columbia Pictures had both Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, and they wanted to keep good relationships with our U.S. Air Force and our politicians. And so you'll find this disclaimer. It's on the front here for Strangelove. It's at the end of the film on Failsafe. But yes, do not think that this could ever really happen. Although, privately, and now publicly, many people that were working for Kennedy and LBJ will tell you that there is uncomfortable similarities to truth throughout this movie. And we also begin with a moment I always forget about, and I wonder if we really need, but we are reminded that there is rumors of a doomsday device as we look out on this Siberian island. And it's just kind of this beautiful shot of mountains poking up through clouds and sets the tone for like a nice, serene, pretty movie.
It's interesting because we have voiceover here at the beginning, and then that narrator pops up again about 10 minutes later. That's it for the voiceover, though. It's very irregular, and in a movie that was trying to play it straight, that would be a problem. Here, as we're dealing with farce, not so much.
Kubrick, again, I think it was a crutch he had to learn to give up. I mean, I do remember that they talked for a long time about 2001 being full of voiceover, and then he wisely decided, no, we can't do that. I think every filmmaker actually wants to be able to tell you how to feel in words and then eventually realizes, let the images do it, back off. And this movie looks great.
Really?
That's in dispute?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Is there a known reason why he chose to shoot black and white in the era where color film was the norm?
Because if you look at any drama from the early 60s, they're all black and white. You only did comedies and musicals in color, and all the dramas, Days of Wine and Roses, Failsafe, all the tough movies, Long Day's Journey into Night, anything you would see at that time, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it was the studio tradition to announce drama in black and white. So the subversion here is that we would think, watching black and white film, this is a straight-faced story. This is going to be dramatically telling us about nuclear threat.
My go-to was Dr. No on this, which had come out and was color and was, you know, a semi-serious action film. So, yeah, I was curious why that was. It's very high grain, and I don't think it looks bad, but I can't say that the visuals in this ever have me awed the way The Shining does.
I think this opening scene, after you're told about the doomsday device, and you get this very romantic, try a little tenderness as B-52s are being penetrated by a phallus and being refueled in the air. Like, it's got a very romantic feel, but it's military plane. It's an image that's burned into my head, just this opening refueling of a plane.
Yeah, the title Dr. Strangelove never sunk in my early watchings of it. The idea that they're really going to go there with the idea that the act of war is also an act of lovemaking. But it's here. It's right here in the romantic way that these planes are refueling each other to these strings and all of that. It's meant to imply that, yes, this is a very strange love indeed that we have with our phalluses and our missiles and our own self-destruction.
Yeah, you can't not see it. The final scene where it pulls out after it's injected its fuel and you have it just kind of bouncing there like a phallus is not subtle. I don't think I got it when I was really young, but this time it's the way it's going in and out and things like that. I think as a kid, I probably just thought, you know, you're refueling planes mid-flight. It can't be that steady. Now I'm like, wait, this is obvious.
I would guess, I don't know, I have no evidence to say that this is true. I would guess many people that just walked into the movie that hadn't heard about it would not get the joke or wouldn't even get that this was a comedy. Again, they're looking at black and white. They know this is about the bomb. Why would that be funny? I mean, maybe the title kind of tells you something. I mean, I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. It's kind of a play on how to succeed in business without really trying, which was a popular satirical book about all the dirty dealings that happen on in the office politics.
I've heard about that, and I didn't ever put together that that's what how I learned to stop worrying was in reference to. I've always found the title with its extension awkward, and watching it the first time, I just thought it was called Strangelove because of the character. It draws very much attention to a really minor character until the end of the film. When writing my plot summary, it drew out for me exactly how little Strangelove really does until the very end.
Yeah, I think it's in there just for the name. Like Stuart said, it's describing this strange love we have where we're going to destroy ourselves. But I do have a question, just logistics. We're told later that these B-52s, I guess they're always up in the air. They're always like 2 hours away from their targets inside the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's actually been confirmed by Robert McNamara and other people that they realized, well, what was happening was it stopped being about bombs and it started being about missiles right around the end of the 50s. Now, all of a sudden, we had long range, didn't have to man it. The feeling was that if they launched missiles, we wanted to be there right away to be able not to stop the missiles themselves, but at least to strike fast. And so, yes, we always had a western route, a southern route. We were always having, I think they said, a dozen or more planes 24 hours a day. Their missions were a full day long. There were usually two pilots in the B-52 for that reason, to make sure that, yes, if they got that word, if that came through, if something had been blown up, that they could respond that quickly.
It is really scary, the more we talk about it, how close we came to complete annihilation.
Yeah, no, it was called Mutually Assured Destruction MAD for a reason. I don't know when that term came about, but yeah, the basic strategy was, we'll just blow everything up. If you hurt me, I'll blow up the world. I'll take my toys home and blow everything up. Like, that is crazy that we lived on the edge of that philosophy.
Yeah, that was a term from the 50s, I believe, if I remember my history right, when they were doing the nuclear bunkers and things. That was all the rage.
Yeah, I don't think that the old generation, the people that were creating the suburbia of the 50s, prospering in the Eisenhower era, I don't think that they would prone to find any of that funny. And in many cases, they were shielded from a lot of that. I mean, it was really Khrushchev and the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis that suddenly they couldn't look away anymore. The threat was becoming too real. Everything that we saw happen, and people from the Manhattan Project had spoken out. Eisenhower himself, when he retired, he was the general that everyone loved. When he left office, said, you got to worry about the military-industrial complex. They're going to kill us all. I mean, he didn't, I'm paraphrasing. But again, it really changed in the 60s, the sense that, yes, this is a very grave matter. And so again, I would hazard a guess many in the audience weren't laughing yet watching this movie as it gets started here. At the Burpleson Air Force Base, I think that is a joke, burp, I'm guessing.
That's how I took it.
Yeah, but that kind of gonzo writing, it definitely would become popular in all kinds of beat generation. I definitely feel a Kerouac sensibility to it all.
Yeah, when you push it so far where you have a President Muffley and a Colonel Bat Guano, like, okay, I get what you're doing. You're not trying to be sly about it. You got your politics on your sleeve, your satire on your sleeve. I see what you're doing. I don't mind, like, because this does go so over the top.
You know, the key to satire is, in my mind, smart humor. And there's nothing smart about these names. It's too obvious for me. And to me, it is the worst joke in the film. There are some bad jokes in here. Humor is subjective and more, I'm on record as saying, and I stand by it, comedies are the genre that ages worst. You know, humor is very in the moment. Maybe to audiences in the 60s, this is hysterical. But to me as a teenager and to me now, I'm just rolling my eyes at it.
No, Arnie, I'm not going to disagree with you. It's not that funny, but it helps us understand character very quickly. If we have a General Ripper, we're not surprised he's going to turn out to be a wackadoodle that's going to try and engage us in World War III. It's just kind of helpful to have these kind of tag names that denote who these people are.
Yeah, but that said, I get that about Ripper immediately based on the performance. I don't need his name to be over the top. And in fact, I didn't even necessarily realize he was Jack D. Ripper when I'm watching it. I just knew him as Ripper. And the president's name didn't become clear to me until I was reading after the fact, but I'm sure it was said somewhere in there.
Exactly. That's my point. It's like, it's not waiting for the laugh. You know, it doesn't like turn, break the fourth wall and say, wasn't that hilarious? It's going to roll right over you. Like a lot of these early jokes, I suspect most people won't know they're in a comedy for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think it's until we get to the war room where that becomes real obvious. I mean, this opening where Ripper is talking to Peter Sellers number one as Mandrake, who's what, a British officer on an exchange program?
Yeah, I think the reason why they include this, it was always weird to me, like, why is this Brit in Texas? But you got to remember, the original book was written by an RAF officer, and I think this was a way of bringing Peter George, who did work on the screenplay, who wrote the book, into the story. Like, he's just now a part of it. And you also, I think, want to have, you know, more of the World War II allied. If there's going to be a German, you want to have a Brit and an American all together fighting the Soviets. I think that makes sense as a world power breakdown.
And yeah, I agree. Early on in this film, I'd say until George C. Scott shows up, you could think this is a completely straight film.
Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think, even when there are jokes, I wouldn't call it a comedy. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't become farcical, I agree, until that war room really lets the Russians in. They let their guard in. It's, I think, subtle isn't the right word because the comedy is broad, but it is a slow boil to get to that uproarious comedy that they're eventually going to try to land on.
Yeah, I really felt that progression. I do think before the war room, again, the introduction of the general where we're seeing his secretary in a bikini and she's doing like this really professional voice on the phone talking to whoever's calling in the emergency versus shouting to the general who's in the bathroom taking a shit. I thought that was the first moment that it cracked a smile.
Oh yeah, there it's here. I do think this movie is always hyper aware of the interplay between sex, death, and war. I mean, again, yes, here is is clearly a hookup scenario. I'm going to bet that George C. Scott's Turgeson, this is not his wife. You know, this is his secretary that he's having an affair with. She even kind of looks like Lolita. She's not blonde, but the glasses and all that, it feels like a carryover from Kubrick's last film. And the fact that, yes, yeah, she's got to be the one to make small talk with this guy that's trying to explain that we're on the verge of nuclear annihilation is a part of the spirit of this movie.
I don't know if the general's married and this is a hookup. I think the secretary calls him later on because he's like, of course I'm going to marry you.
Yeah. Do you think that means that he couldn't be married?
I didn't see a ring on his finger, and I think it was a hookup, but I didn't think he was cheating on anybody.
Yeah, again, yeah, it's not a debate I really want to have. We are introduced to him, and George C. Scott feels like pure Tex Avery. Like, this is somebody that would go after the Wabbit in a Looney Tunes. He's very big. He's Elmer Fudd. He's Yosemite Sam. You know, the fact that he wants there to do a countdown toward orgasm, that's that face he makes, blast off! I mean, all of that, just it feels completely like Warner Brothers era Tex Avery.
Oh, yeah, he's got the full Jim Carrey rubber face going on at times on this.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen a George C. Scott performance like this one, you know? When I think of George C. Scott, I sadly think of, Firestarter is my go-to.
What?
But then Exorcist 3.
Not Patton, the Native American from the Stephen King movie.
Yeah, that one. I've never seen Patton.
Okay, fair enough. He's done farce plenty. I mean, The Hospital is a really good one, actually, that I enjoyed him in. It wouldn't be abnormal for him. He's always kind of playing louts. It's usually more of a surprise when, like, we get Exorcist 3 and we're being told, like, he's the good guy in the film. It's like, what? You're no leading man.
But he's been called up because Ripper enacted Plan R, and we're going to see just focus on one of the B-52s. You know, I think that's a smart choice, that just focus on the one crew that's going to matter. And did you catch it, Arnie? James Earl Jones is part of that crew?
Yes, I did. And I did not know that coming back. I noticed his name in the opening credits, and he doesn't speak much, but the moment he speaks, I'm like, oh, that is James Earl Jones. I had to do some math. I'm like, how old is that man?
Yeah, I think he was a little more than a teenager when it was one of his first films that he's here. But yeah, it's kind of a fun cameo.
Yeah, of course, the head is Slim Pickens as Major King Kong, talking about those broad comedic names.
I mean, his real name is, quote unquote, Slim Pickens. So.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about with this movie, with everyone else's name.
His name is TJ Kong. His nickname is King Kong because he's so mighty, presumably. I mean, he's a Texas stereotype. Kubrick knew him from One-Eyed Jacks, the Brando movie that he was robbed of. He was one of the few things that was good about that experience, and so he brought him on board. Slim Pickens was supposed to play the Scatman role in Shining. That was his first choice. They were good friends, so he could have been someone that worked with Kubrick more than once.
I can't picture that.
But who you should really picture is Peter Sellers, because that was what Columbia Pictures wanted. It's what Kubrick actually said they were going to do. They dressed him up. They shot a few scenes. And then, conveniently, maybe, Peter Sellers broke his leg and said, I can't do it. There's a lot of different stories about why Peter Sellers is not playing Kong. And the one that seems to have the most credibility is Sellers was getting tired of doing multiple Kubrick takes. You know, Kubrick doesn't do three takes and we're done. And Sellers is an improviser. He wants to, okay, I'm going to give you this, and then I want to move on. I don't want to just repeat what I do again and again and again. 14, 15, 16 takes of three characters already. This was some of the last stuff they shot. He just maybe took himself out of the role, and Slim Pickens was a last-minute replacement that I can't imagine not being here.
It is, again, one of my memories of this movie. I mean, it's one of the iconic images is him at the end.
Yeah, that is the movie.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Sellers is an excellent mimic. I'm sure he could do a funny yokel, but it works for me that we've had this guy here. Maybe it would make sense if Peter Sellers was everywhere. Maybe that would help unify, but it's essentially three different places we keep bouncing from. We're going to bounce from this plane back to the base and back to the war room for much of the movie. And while he's playing three different characters, two of them are in the war room.
And the war room is where the majority of the action takes place. We get there not long after the B-52 gets its orders, and you wouldn't think a bunch of people sitting in a war room around a table would be where the action occurs, but in this case it very much is. But there's a lot of people in that room. We focus on three or four of them.
Now, you say you were not impressed with the look of this movie. That room doesn't bowl you over. I mean, everyone talked about how amazing this set was. Like, it was huge.
you know, you bringing it up, yeah, I don't feel a lot of the shots took great advantage of that and really showed it off. I mean, we're dealing with a lot of two shots in this and conversations. We're not dealing with sweeping establishing shots except at the beginning. It didn't register the way, again, the landscape shots of The Shining and the way the street shots in Eyes Wide Shut really did.
Okay, I mean, I feel like his eye is in evidence here, and what he said he did here was, you can't see it because it's black and white, but he insisted that table be painted green because he was trying to give the impression this is a poker game. All the people here are buying in, and all of our lives are one big game of chance, and you're watching. I mean, I kind of see it now, once that was pointed out to me. The circular light, the way it looks like the way so many noir gambling dens are photographed throughout the 40s and 50s. This is the war room as a smuggler's paradise.
And we got George C. Scott in there chewing up the scenery and chewing up the gum. This was quite an ad for chewing gum.
Yes. And by this point, he has to be the one to explain to this put-upon president, who I applaud Sellers. He's so big in his other parts. He really is going to play this one very low to the ground. This is his straight man. He is not going to do a whole lot of mugging as the president of the United States. And it was discussed. He tried on different voices and ultimately decided, with Kubrick's input, this would be better played as reactionary as opposed to Gonzo.
I didn't recognize Sellers as the president. The bald cap, the performance, the accent, all fooled me. I didn't realize till after this movie was done that was Sellers. I knew Strangelove and the fake mustache. I mean, that his performance as Mandrake reminded me a lot of the Pink Panther, but I didn't see him in this president.
Well, Pink Panther's French. Clouseau.
There's something about the way he does the accents and the performance that maybe it's the mustache.
Yeah, I think it's the mustache, Arnie. They're not really the same performance. I mean, I think they're quite varied, but it's a comic performance. What he's doing as the British joke is, you know, what we always think of the British, right? Like, if they're faced with nuclear annihilation, they're going to be like,
stiff upper lip.
Yeah, excuse me, I think you have something wrong. The radio seems to be working, you know, like, just really play down the fact that they're ineffective, unemotional, that pent up kind of chap.
This kind of had to be controversial, like how he plays the American president, like that he's supposed to be a tough guy and stand there and lead the nation. And this President Muffley, the way he plays him is just so mealy-mouthed and apologetic and just a wuss.
But this guy is going to be told that, hey, yeah, this crazy general in Texas ordered all of our planes to drop their nukes. We don't really have a good way of calling them off. So why don't we just do it? Why don't we just blow up the Soviet Union? We'll wipe out 90% of their capabilities and we'll just suck up the other 10%.
Yeah, that's a interesting response. It lets us know that George C. Scott's general is more on the page of Ripper than he is of the president.
And if you watch Failsafe, the same thing gets suggested, only no jokes. Again, like, it's comfortable to laugh, but it's even more, like, dark to think, like, wow, would people actually draw that conclusion? I mean, what is said in the book, if you read it in the book, they compare it to Ricky Ticky Tavi. I don't know if people know that kid's story.
Oh, yeah, I loved that from when I was a kid.
Never heard of it.
About a mongoose who fights cobras.
Yeah, yeah, it's set in India, and he's like a little rat pet of this family, and they get a nest of cobras, and there's this whole discussion about should he eat the eggs of the cobras, because once they hatch, they'll be too big a problem. That story is well known in the 60s, I guess more so than it is now, and the generals are relating that in the way of saying, if we let communists flourish, one day we won't be able to stop the Soviets. So, yeah, let's just live with this. Let's just strike. That was political thinking of the time, and Turgidson is based on a real-life character.
That's exceptionally frightening.
Well, I mean, Ripper does say, you know, we got to take war out of the hands of the politicians. That's too dangerous. You got to have the generals in charge.
But they're going to bring in the Russian ambassador. They're going to try to make nice and say, we didn't really do this, and see if diplomacy with Russia will allow the Russians to be like, yeah, okay, we got blown up, but they didn't mean it.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, props on Muffley. Like, we like Muffley now. Satire, usually all characters are equally despicable, and that's kind of why it works, is that you realize the world is corrupt, and thus you just laugh at everyone. No one gets out unscathed. But I actually find myself feeling like, oh, Muffley is the voice of reason. He is going to save people. Incidentally, by the way, it was not U.S. policy not to strike first. Like all the political guys that watched this film said, oh yeah, many things are right, but we definitely didn't have that opinion.
And you might have liked Buffley because he's moving for peace, but come on, when he gets on this phone call with the Soviet premier after talking to their ambassador, to me, this is one of the funniest scenes. It, like, the premier, I think he's drunk because that was our, you know, that's the Russian stereotype, but he's apologizing for not calling the premier just to say hi, that he only calls him. And I don't know if you guys have heard the song. It's not even really a song. It's more of just a skit by the Dead Kennedys called Kinky Sex Makes the World Go Round. And it's someone from the State Department calling the president. It just reminds, I mean, they take it even further where it just becomes a phone sex call. Like the president's moaning and orgasming. But like, I feel like they took this scene and pushed it even further. It is the first real moment where I'm like, oh yeah, this is on point with its satire. And I'm cracking up where, yeah, you got to go through. How's it going? How's the family as nuclear annihilation looms overhead?
Yeah, this is my favorite moments of comedy right here. My feeling about the film is it has an arc of comedy where it does start serious and the comedy just builds upon itself and builds upon itself. And here at around the half hour mark is where I actually find this film quite amusing and I'm smiling along with it, with this call to the premiere, with the ambassador coming in and having a camera planted on him. This stuff to me holds up as actually funny and not ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's coming to the point I was making earlier, 42 minutes in. It took a long time to finally say, farce! Like, things were quirky, things were funny. Yeah, the guys in the plane were unpacking their kits and finding little miniature Russian phrase books and Bibles and condoms. It had an element of satire, but I don't feel like we were invited to laugh hard and continuously in the way that a comedy does until we've hit this point. And from this point on, they keep that momentum going, or at least try to. Can you imagine how I feel, Dimitri? I mean, yeah, that stuff is great.
And also, just a note for listeners who haven't watched this film recently, if you do, this scene will set off your Amazon Echo many times as the ambassador is named Alexei.
How funny. Yes, Alexei and Dimitri. And they got a great Russian. I gotta say, Peter Bull, like, he's got a stone face. If you're gonna have Peter Sellers be mugging like this, it's even better when he's surrounded by someone that just can't even crack a smile. Like, Peter Bull is just perfect compliment to him sitting right next to him. And so it is Peter Bull's Alexei that really gets back on the phone and realizes why, no matter what happens with the bomb dropping, it can't be forgiven because there's a doomsday device.
Yeah, again, this is where I find it funny. We have Sellers here as Strangelove, who's like, a doomsday device only works if people know about it. Well, we were going to announce it Monday.
Yeah, no, it's great. And Strangelove, I think this is his first introduction. He kind of just comes out to rebuke Alexei for, you know, not the Russians not telling them about it. Because, you know, like you said, that's the whole purpose of a doomsday device. But yeah, this character of Strangelove, like, he's going to make this point and then kind of fall back until the very end of this film.
Here's something that's not funny. Eisenhower actually built a doomsday device. It was made. They were planning to implement it. And if they had it operational during the Cuban Missile Crisis, none of us would be here right now. But they decided wisely not to go forward in the early 60s.
My thought was, when they're describing it, I'm like, so would Chernobyl have counted as the nuclear strike and set off the doomsday device?
We would have never even gotten there, Artie. Like, that's not even, yeah. But yeah, probably.
What was the actual plan? Because the way it's described here, like, if any strategic sites are hit by nukes, or if you even try to dismantle it, it's going to go off. It's just ran by a computer, like what Eisenhower had, that sophisticated, like no one could stop it.
No, I do think that it's in Kubrick's conception to think of computers as so logical that they always conclude that mankind should just be eliminated. Think of HAL. Ultimately, he just realizes, let's just cut the lifeline to those guys. And we're going to talk about AI. But that was not what it was going to be. We didn't have artificial intelligence. There would have been no automatic response. It would have required somebody pulling the lever.
So it was like Red Alert, the book.
Essentially, the idea was that if we ever got hit, we would just say, fuck it, and release enough nuclear explosions that the whole world... Again, the whole idea is deterrence. We weren't going to do that. But if you thought that we could, then you would never try anything. But of course, a Nazi might actually go forward with that. And it is startling to see a Dr. Strangelove, so clearly a movie villain. I mean, like, just played in such a campy fashion, always fighting back his Zig Heils in that gloved hand. The idea that they're in the American war room,
which we did bring them over, like, they're scientists, we did bring over to work with us. Like, I don't know how well known that was in 1964 when this would have come out.
Yeah, Kubrick did his research, but yeah, it's an uncomfortable truth that some Nazis got to become Americans and work with us on the space program and, yeah, the missile program.
It's Strangelove where the humor starts going over the top for me, with the arm that seems to have a life of its own and some of his stuff.
It's big.
Yeah, too big.
I mean, is it too big when Ash does it in Evil Dead 2? I mean, I think what's strange is this movie hasn't been big like this, and all of a sudden it's telling us, oh, we're super farce. I mean, it is kind of like, still kind of stunning to this day to see the tone shift so dramatically within this 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, even watching it now, like, I knew where it goes with this character, but it's still, like, I remember when I first watched it, I'm like, what? We got, like, a Nazi just showing up all of a sudden? And even now, though, it's a wild turn. I go with it, though. I think it works commenting on our policies at the time. Again, where we would work with Nazis to get ahead of the Russians.
I think where I'm at with him is where kind of Muffly is. At first, it's like, what? What are you talking about? But by the end of it, there's a strange calculation to letting Peter Sellers do this so that they can reach the ending that they're going to do, which I don't think anyone that watches the movie today is clueless to the idea that the bomb is going to drop at the end. But in 1964, I think the audiences would naturally assume movies just didn't go that bleak. It would be a very strange thing indeed. I mean, there had been a movie on the beach about this kind of thing, but they always managed to find a happy ending, a silver lining. It would have been inconceivable to have a farce end the way that it's going to with a, you know, explosion of mushroom clouds. But you need a Nazi in order to get there, I think, in order to see that that's funny and a happy ending. But equally impressive, I think, is Sterling Hayden. You could have had Peter Sellers play Ripper, right? He could have just played all the crazy characters. The guy that's going to ride the bomb, the Nazi in the war room, and the guy who initiated World War III to begin with. But I kind of like the fact that Sterling Hayden is like from Failsafe. He truly is playing it straight. He's never really telling jokes. It is for Peter Sellers to react and to let us know that it's kind of funny that he's initiated all of this because he didn't want fluoride in our children's ice cream.
And more that he got tired after sex one time. Like, that's just called having sex. You get tired after it. And it's hilarious coming from this actor because, yeah, he is so straight. He is probably the one straight character in here, but he gives the craziest speeches, but no sense of irony in the way he delivers it.
Yeah, I agree. It's anachronistic in a good way that he is saying such crazy shit. Initially, his speech about don't leave the war to the politicians, I kind of can agree with some mindset of that. You know, there's all the stuff about the politicians' kids didn't have to go fight in Vietnam, so they have no stakes in the game. They can send people off to die. But the more he goes off into the fluids and the fluoride and all of that, Peter Sellers is the one who really sells the comedy. If Peter Sellers wasn't there to react that way, you might think that this movie was just fucking stupid.
Yeah, you would just think he was crazy, as I think we're like, well, that's a madman. Instead, really, again, with a name like this, putting it thematically, it's suddenly like, yeah, the real fear is impotence. The real fear is not being able to perform. Mother Russia and Uncle Sam are in a porno, and you got to be able to do it. And this guy, by equating it to a sexual term, the whole nuclear war, World War III, again, the dick measuring contest that is this movie, it's a perfectly logical conclusion to all the madness that we're watching. And by the way, the John Birch Society, which was an anti-communist society, was very against putting fluoride in the water. They were leading an outcry throughout the 1950s. So it would have been a voice recognizable to audiences in 1964.
And I've heard that, I mean, it's kind of a fun conspiracy theory that I've heard throughout my life, is the fluoride in the water is some form of mind control and all of that. I mean, I think that those stories continue today, even if nobody takes them seriously.
It was mentioned in Us, actually. If you were a silver level donor, you heard that.
Is this working for you guys, all of this sexual imagery for war, the overtness of it, the lack of subtlety in regards to it, the way it is all like the two airplanes humping at the beginning? Is that working for you?
Well, it's not like it's a joke about, ha ha ha, look at the planes fucking. They're being serious about it. They're actually saying this is really the problem with our world leaders. And I think there is an element of truth to that. I mean, I do think it's where the movie in humor lands on something that is true.
Yeah, I think that this whole potential World War III is a lover spat. I think that is kind of subtext. It's there if you want to see dongs coming out of airplanes and all that, the way Ripper talks about fluids. I think all that stuff's there, but I think if you're kind of a naive person, you could watch this and go, oh, this is just kind of a weird, funny Cold War film.
Yeah, I don't think we're supposed to be laughing about it like the same way that we were about the phone call.
Yeah, it's not a sex comedy.
No, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying, is it working for you, the whole metaphor slash symbolism of it? Because to me, I just feel like it's an obvious target to hit. I feel like it's punching down.
Well, it wouldn't be in 1964. I do think that because we have beatniks and writers that are going to, you know, really Gravity's Rainbow and all the anti-war writings that would come in the Vietnam era, I think it became very obvious to everyone. We've all heard about the, you know, equating of missiles to penises, and that these are men that just have inferiority complexes getting us into trouble. It's an idea that has been hashed out, so I suppose it's less funny or less eye-opening than it used to be, but I can give props to something that put it forward before it was, I think, popularized.
Yeah, and more so when this film does try to kind of play it straight, you're going to have this big fight at the base. I'm like, it feels perfunctionary. It's like, okay, we got to show this stuff to move the plot along, but I'm glad Bat Guano shows up and lectures Mandrake about having to own up to the Coca-Cola company to shoot the machine to get change out. Like, that is the stuff I gravitate towards. When you have these battles going on outside the base, I'm like, okay, I get it. You got to show the fight, but let's move on.
But the battle reflects his mood. Like, I mean, at one point, he's looking a lot like Robert Duvall in Apocalypse Now. He's standing in front of the window as the bullets are flying in and pulling out of his golf bag a machine gun. And
oh, no, that stuff is good. Yeah,
I'm just saying, like, that's when he's feeling virile. And then when he realizes he's going to lose, that's when he starts talking about women wanting his essence, not being able to perform. Like, again, it's almost like we've watched a man ejaculate. I'll just go ahead and put it that way. Like, he's spent, and now there's nothing to do other than a very well-timed comedic suicide. Like, I gotta say, the timing in him going into the bathroom, Peter Sellers trying to, not seeing what everyone else can see.
Yeah, still being British and trying to talk reason to him.
That bang, and then him pushing on the door, not being able to open it. That is just great physical humor.
I enjoyed that scene. My only thing is, it's been a long time since I've seen this. The way Peter Sellers is holding that giant machine gun aimed at the bathroom, I couldn't tell if Ripper would kill himself or if Sellers would accidentally kill him with the machine gun going off. That was my tension in the scene.
But yeah, you mentioned Bat Guano, who Keenan Wynn, I think he would end up playing this kind of doofus character on many a sitcom to follow. Yeah, he's just kind of blowing in here. You would think liberating this base, but actually clueless to what he was doing and making it seem like getting in trouble with the Coca-Cola company is a bigger deal than World War III. He has no idea what the stakes are.
And I guess this does play into something that I find personally humorous in films, and probably because I love Time Bandit so much and Terry Gilliam, is just the hilarity, the banality of bureaucracy. Like, Mandrake is trying to get this call in, refigured out the code to give to the planes. He doesn't have enough change. No one will put him through to the White House. I don't know. This kind of stuff is just funny to me when you're trying to save the world and people are going to get caught up on little rules and checkboxes that got to be marked before you move on.
Yeah, it feels true. It feels like something that I personally connect with. Like, there is always this bullshit you've got to deal with when stakes are high. And yeah, some of this is very broad. The splash in the face joke may have been too far.
Yeah, that one goes a little too far.
I can admit that not everything here is gold, but most of it, 80% of it.
The stuff that doesn't work for me is so little, it actually does stick out. Like, he shoots the Coke machine and the Coke sprays his face. Like, I remember those little moments because I'm like, oh, that wasn't funny, and I've been enjoying this so much.
I'm the opposite. The moments that stick out for me are the ones where I do find it funny after that initial war room scene. And the rest, I'm getting existential while watching this. I'm like, well, why am I not finding it funny? Is it that this humor is now 60 years old and I just have seen these jokes redone or parodied or referenced?
Do Do you not see this danger, though, in modern politics? And I don't know. I still think this could happen with the Russians.
And to be clear, I you're saying it's not funny. I don't think you have to be rolling on the ground holding your gut. Maybe it isn't totally working as that kind of comedy. But are you into the movie? Like, I mean, it's still kind of tense to know that, like, everything could explode. Like, we're on the razor's edge.
The comedy is taking me out of that tension. It worked great the first half hour. But the more that they tell what are to me unfunny jokes, the less I care if they drop the bomb on all these people.
Oh, okay. Well, I definitely feel like that is a constant, that even if it doesn't match your sensibilities in terms of what's funny and what you want to watch for light humor, I do think, yeah, it's still tense.
Yeah, I think it would have worked a lot better anytime from the 60s through the 80s, when the Cold War was at its peak. I do think that tension only had to be hinted at that time to spark fear in everybody. These days, I can't tell if it's just because I've lived with the idea so long or if it's because the Cold War theoretically ended in the 80s, that I'm very blasé about the thought of nuclear war. It's not as frightening as it was.
Admittedly, it's not on my mind right now, although Annihilation...
Annihilation is, though.
Yeah, I get that, but I still feel like movies have to be about more than your own personal experience. They have to be more than what is relevant. Like, they have the ability to work both as commentary on now and being something timeless.
I agree completely, and I just, that's where I feel this film is failing.
I feel like there's something very timeless about the idea that these two enemies hate each other so bad they want to fuck, or maybe vice versa. I don't know. It feels right. And again, I feel just jazzed by the fact that they've turned it into a joke. That American spirit, that there's going to be those guys that lift that flag at Iwo Jima. Somehow we're going to get the mission done. American do or die, we always find a way, is now turned into a very bad thing. Because Slim Pickens and his crew are going to defy all the odds and drop that bomb, even though, God knows, in a million different ways, the world is trying to tell them stop.
Yeah, you got that great Johnny Comes Marching Home. Again, there's only like three songs in this whole film, but like that Johnny Comes Marching Home, like that rat-a-tat of the drums is so prominent every time you cut to that B-52 bomber. Again, that's your patriotic moment. And my memory was, and I guess it came from the book. I haven't read that book since high school. Like, I read that after I saw the film. But I thought in this film you'd have a lot more dogfights and the plane dodging stuff. It gets hit by a missile and it keeps flying. I think in the book it's doing a lot more theatrical fighting and you just get those hero moments more. And look, I see I don't even know what kind of screens they use here. Blue, green, the way that plane is matted over backdrops. Not the greatest looking thing. I'm going to give it a buy because it's 1964. But I did think, my memory was that this plane did do more heroic things. It kind of just flies through though.
In the book, there is more death. There is a lot of people on a plane. First of all, that was a big surprise to me that you would have 10, 12 people in a bomber. I just didn't think they were staffed that heavily. But again, if you're going out for 24 hours, you got to have people that are fresh that can pop in for people when they get tired. So yeah, there were people that got killed. And yeah, there was constantly machine malfunction in the book that, again, there was a lot more excitement to the idea that, is this crew going to live? Are they going to make it?
I appreciate that amount of realism to it. I do like the supporting crew. They don't get much to do on that plane, but they help add the realism that Slim Pickens doesn't.
Well, I mean, if his Slim Pickens was just doing a suicide mission, you'd say, oh, he's a crazy Texan. But he knows he's taking his men out. And there is something very sad about him giving that speech when he realized, you know, there's not enough fuel to go back. We're all going to just have to do this. But let's just commit to being Americans, because God knows we celebrate this so much. They found a way to do it. The boys back home need us to drop this bomb. And if we can't do it on the target, we'll avert and we'll go to the target that was in the book. And that's what they've changed here, is that they decide that there's another base that they can make since they're running out of fuel. And unfortunately, the Russians were waiting for them at the primary and secondary target and probably could have taken them out. Again, there's so many opportunities for this not to be successful. The bomb doors are jammed and Slim Pickens is going to go down there to rewire it.
Yeah, I think if you approach this film, and again, I don't know how you don't know it's a farce by this point, but they really do build that tension. Okay, release the bombs. Oh no, there's a malfunction. Try this, try that. Finally, you got to go and manually open. Like, they play it out like it's a very tense moment that we want our American boys to succeed on this mission.
And I have always loved Dear John as a name for a bomb. Like, I just thought that was always like, hi there and Dear John, great names.
Hi there, I like Dear John, I didn't get.
That's what a girl would write to her man, like especially a soldier, when she's breaking up with him.
Oh, I know what a Dear John letter is. I don't see how it relates to, you know, the thing. Hi there, you know, it's very funny to think that's what they're going to see as they're getting bombed. Dear John, I didn't understand.
You don't get the idea that the emotional reaction to having your girlfriend break up with you while you're on a mission would feel like a bomb?
Or just that we're breaking up with the Soviet Union by destroying the world.
Anyway, that's not the one he rides down. He rides down hi there, and it's not funny. I mean, I've always get chills when I watch that scene. There's just something about the sound design and the way that he's going down there, and it just cuts to white that just, yeah, it's always spooked me. It's like that moment when Hal cuts the oxygen line and the guy goes flipping off into the void. Like, it just, something about that is just primally terrifying.
It is the way he's doing, like, yeehaw. Yeah, that sound design.
Terrifying to me.
His yeehaw and the bad rear screen projection effects have always made this scene not work for me.
I don't know what to say other than it is the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it has been parried a million times.
As great as Peter Sellers is, Slim Pickens steals it out from under him in this moment.
I think it's too big. You know, him having the big nuclear missile phallus between his legs.
But that's not the joke. The joke is not, ha ha ha, I'm going to stick my penis in you. It, like, again, there's just some kind of Tex Avery quality to, like, I mean, you can see, like, Coyote doing this to Roadrunner, right? Like, there's something about this that feels like we've taken one of our cartoons and then recast it, redyed it in the moment of the Cuban Missile Crisis to a way that it's poisonous and sad and horrifying. I mean, again, I would be very surprised if anyone watching this movie laughs when he's going down like that.
And I'm not saying I'm laughing. I'm saying it's certainly not horrifying. What I'm saying is his performance would undercut any horror that I could have with this scene watching it. It always has.
It is this weird mix, again, of American exceptionalism, that cowboy attitude that we tend to be projected upon us by other countries. And yeah, the horror of nuclear annihilation. It is this like a kind of perfect ball rolled up into a little symbol there that gets dropped at the end.
It could almost be the ending. The fact that we go back to the war room one more time. I mean, I see the necessity of Dr. Strangelove in that scene. It is his scene now because he's the only one that has the vision to where they go next. I mean, like, fucking for 100 years in a mine shaft build of master race. Yeah, Mein Führer. I mean, it's all coming out now. And again, I wasn't getting it earlier when he was introduced, but now the logic, the cold rationale of having Dr. Strangelove here to guide the way. And the idea that the Soviets and the Americans are still going to be 100 years from now worrying about a mine shaft gap. And yes. Who's going to control the planet after it's been irradiated?
And I didn't like this scene when I saw this when I was younger. I thought Sellers was... I didn't like the Sieg Heil. I didn't like the Mein Führer stuff. Again, it always just bothered me as too much. But the rest of the scene, the mine gap and all of that, the way George C. Scott reacts at the thought of 10 women for every one man because of...
And they got to be perfect specimens.
And chosen because of their sexual prowess. Yeah. I mean, that stuff, it's a high note to go out on, other than I wish they hadn't gone so Nazi with him, because I feel that's a bad German stereotype.
Maybe less so in 1964. Again, it was still close enough. Judgment at Nuremberg, a black and white drama from that time.
Yeah, and we threw Japanese people in internment camps in World War II. Are you saying being against all Germans was acceptable back then, or just that it was done?
I mean, Dr. Strangelove is an actual Nazi.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is what we think of German people. I'm saying that we recruited Nazis to work on the space race and the missile program, and suddenly they're guiding us to this. Again, it feels totally right. But would a pie fight work? It is the long-lost scene that's not on even the Blu-ray. It's way gone. From what I understand, the way that it was supposed to work is that shortly after Strangelove realizes he can walk, there are pies. and they get thrown because that's what you do at the end of a big farce. I think Casino Royale ended in similar manner.
Yes, I was just about to say the Bond parody film did it.
Yeah, I wish the pie fight was left out of Dawn of the Dead, the original one, and I'm glad it's left out here.
Yeah, the idea, and I think it's obvious, but I'll explain it anyway, the idea is we're going to see them reverted to children. They look ridiculous, and there are two thinkings as to why it got cut. One is that President Muffley takes a big heaping of pies, and someone says, the president has been shot. This movie is coming out 2 months after JFK was assassinated. They thought it was in bad taste, and they cut it. But there's also just the thinking that Kubrick himself said, not working, takes the spotlight away from what I want, which is to think about those mushroom clouds. And so the editors that worked with him said it was brilliant, and they loved it. They wish they had retained it. But it's not here because Kubrick didn't want it, for whatever reason. And instead, we'll meet again.
Yeah, as the bombs go off, and again, growing up from the Cold War, just seeing this kind of imagery as a kid, it's horrifying, but it's also fascinating to me. It's just, there's something beautiful about mushroom clouds.
There is. I mean, again, and that's where this movie lives, is like, on one hand, this destruction is so satisfying. It's so seductive. But yes, of course, it's not appealing. Like, ultimately, like, it's it's the attraction repulsion, the fear and desire that we're experiencing here. And does it feel different now that we live in an era where our president is very close to Russia and there isn't this threat of Cold War in the same way that it was? I still feel like Russia is characterized as a threat.
I mean, isn't Putin president forever now? They changed something in their constitution. He's president for a very long time. I don't discount the Cold War totally being over.
Yeah. And you know, funny side note, Oliver Stone did a documentary about Putin, went over there and decided, hey, have you ever seen Dr. Strangelove? And filmed the man watching this movie.
Oh, jeez.
He didn't laugh. Didn't enjoy it.
I gotta say, though, I do like the end song, you know, with the bombs. That is an irony that I think is smart, and I really do enjoy. Again.
Yeah, we'll meet again.
Yeah, and it should be also pointed out, the last joke before this is that the Russian guy did have a camera in the war room. Again, the whole conclusion, cynical though it may be, is you can't change our basic nature. We must destroy each other. It's just a part of the mating dance that we do.
Well, part of the mating dance we do is always ending with, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Dr. Strangelove? Jacob.
Satires are a different, you know, it's a different genre of comedy, or maybe not even really comedy, because, yeah, I'm not always laughing out loud at satires, because you're seeing maybe the danger, the cynicism, what they're getting at, but there is always that sense of dark humor there, which I appreciate. Someone who likes dark humor, I gravitate kind of to satires, and I like good ones. There's a lot of bad ones out there. Like, this year, one of the few movies that actually got released in theaters, finally, The Hunt, it tries to be a satire, but it felt like it was just shooting off buzzwords of our time. Social justice warrior, crisis actor, and I'm like, that doesn't make it satirical. This is satirical. This is getting at what was going on in the country at that moment, or around the world, really, and it does so in a darkly comedic way that it just shows the craziness. Like this, yeah, the State Department's going to tell us this isn't really how things are at the beginning of this film. The scary thing is they actually are. Like, life is kind of this dark farce if you look too closely at how it works, and I think Dr. Strangelove really gets at the heart of that, and I think it's even true today in different ways. Like, you talk about reactions and delays to getting medical supplies for what's going on right now and all that. Like, that stuff is still going on. And so, yeah, this is one of my favorite Kubrick films. This is definitely a strong recommend for Dr. Strangelove.
Stuart.
Yeah, I was, admittedly, already I said it, I was a little worried because it has been decades since I've seen it, but I still love it. I still think that, yeah, it's great. Maybe a little sophomoric pieces, but not as much as I thought. I mean, again, the broad stuff you tend to remember. You remember the biggest notes, but a lot of this is just a feverish nightmare. A lot of it is played so straight that, again, it feels like failsafe. It feels like there's nothing funny about it all. It's deadly, deadly serious. It's just that Kubrick has the right heart and head to really tackle the idea that we can push this into a place that makes us I think most people will laugh. I do think that at this day and age, we have embraced the black comedy in a way that we didn't maybe decades before. In 1964, this movie didn't win Best Picture. And part of that is because many people didn't get the joke or didn't want to get the joke. There's some things you don't laugh about. But now in this day and age, the era of Trump, I think, yeah, all gloves are off. And I think this movie does a great job of concluding that world politics is a big dick measuring contest. And Sellers, I mean, my God, one of his greatest screen performances. He is Kubrick's greatest on-screen muse. I feel like a lot of times when you watch Kubrick movies, they're a little bit marred because of some central performance, be it Shelley Duvall or Matthew Modine or Tom Cruise or somebody. I always feel like, eh. But Sellers is it, man. He is the one best equipped to bring Kubrick's madness and comedy to the screen, and particularly his president. I want to cite his president as actually my favorite of the three. I think we've seen a lot of parodies of Brits and Nazis, but Muffly, he pioneered that cringe comedy we still appreciate in The Office. There is some kind of office comedy to all of this, the bureaucracy of it all. And so, yeah, I definitely feel like it's a classic that holds up nearly 55 years later, and it's the highest of recommends.
Coming back to this, I was excited at the chance to revisit this. I had never really thought about doing it based on my early reaction, and I was like, you know, it is time. It's time that I come back to this. We've reviewed a lot of Kubrick, and as Stuart pointed out in one of them, I start most of the Kubrick podcast by saying how much I disagree with people's love of Kubrick, and then I end up recommending all the films that we've covered of his, even if it's a little conditional, like 2001. So coming back to this, I was like, well, maybe there's something I just didn't see, I was too young to see, or I didn't have the knowledge of history that I have now, and so I didn't get its place in time, and coming back, I'd be able to see more of that. And I do want to thank both of you for helping me understand a little bit why this film is as lauded as it is. Hearing your guys' admiration of this is like a Rosetta Stone for this film to me, because when I look at it, what I see is in a language I don't understand, I suppose. I'm not able to read what Kubrick has written here in a way that is at all intelligent. I mean, that's the word I'll use. I don't find any of it insightful or frightening.
You don't find any of it insightful or frightening?
No.
But you've been saying this whole podcast that it's been terrifying to realize how true to life it was.
Right. You're telling me things about it being true to life, but watching the film, I never expected that we'd actually have built a doomsday device. The reality is scarier than any movie.
Yeah, but we had things like MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. Like, those, you knew those concepts, and I think even if you don't know, there really might have been a doomsday device, people could understand the politics of this film.
Yeah, and again, you grew up in the 80s I grew up in. The bomb was always going to be dropping. I mean, we always live with that fear.
Yet this movie, I mean, it reminds me of it, but it doesn't recreate that fear in me. But, you know, I found it funnier than I remembered finding it. I did enjoy, like I said, for like the second half hour when the humor is really starting before it gets too muffly, I really do enjoy where that film is. Had it stayed at that tone, then this is a film I could have recommended. As it is, it's a weak not recommend. I can't endorse this film. I don't think it holds up. I think, like so many older films that are called the greatest of all time, I have yet to see anyone do a best films of all time list where anything made in the 21st century is in the top 10. So I think old films are held up as classics because it's the way it's always been, and I don't think this film deserves its lauds.
Okay, I'll throw A1. I would put Her in my list of all-time greatest films. That was made pretty recently.
Yeah, There Will Be Blood for me is like one of the greatest. That's 2008, I think, 2007.
Yeah, I think there are people that like movies from all periods of time. What I do wonder, though, is do you like political comedy? Like, is there ones that are in the spirit of Strangelove that do it better? Wag the Dog or...
See, yeah, that was one I was about to go to, is my memory is, and I haven't seen it since theaters, but my memory is I really do enjoy Wag the Dog. And I don't know if you'd count it, but Dave, I like.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stakes are a little different, but it's political and a comedy.
Isn't that a rom-com?
It is a little bit more like a Frank Capra, yeah, romantic comedy. But okay, I'll go with whatever you can give me. But interesting to note, they're all fairly recent movies. Nothing older.
But I don't watch a lot of political older movies.
I mean, is there a thought on why?
I don't watch a lot of older movies. I mean, I do from time to time. I certainly did when I was in college and taking all those film classes where they were assigned. But it is the quote-unquote classics that I go back to. I have Mr. Smith Goes to Washington on my TiVo. I haven't gotten to it yet. But, you know, when I do look back at older films, a lot of times what I'm watching are more noir films and less political films.
Okay, fair enough. Well, it'd be interesting to find out at some point if we could go back and see another one, whether your problem is with Kubrick or maybe just the era. Because they were going to bring this back. When Kubrick died, Terry Gilliam actually came out and said, you know, I was approached by Terry Southern, the co-writer of the script, to say, you have the vision, you can work with my idea and make Children of Strangelove. 100 years later, we see everyone coming out of the mine shafts, and I think it would be brilliant.
Oh, if it's Gilliam behind it, I'm all for it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be a sequel, unlike that Shining shit that we had to watch last year. I do think, like, that's a sequel to a Kubrick movie that should happen. But maybe 12 Monkeys is that sequel when I think about it. It is about children of the future, like reflecting on a, it wasn't nuclear, but a post-apocalyptic Earth.
Yeah, I don't think this film should be sequeled any more than, you know, because people do have a love for this film. No sequel could ever live up, right? It will always be deemed lesser because it would be a sequel. And it wouldn't be in people's minds the way this was. It wouldn't have the nostalgia and the memory that this has. So yeah, if you look at 12 Monkeys or something like that, that's the way to go with any sequel. Follow up on the ideas. Don't try to make, you know, How I Still Love the Bomb.
They're still talking about Casablanca 2. I mean, yeah, it's irresistible, right? It's a strange love.
Are they talking about any movies right now? I don't think anything's being done at the moment.
Well, we're going to keep talking about movies because thank goodness there's a giant catalog to explore, even though there may be nothing coming out in theaters. If you haven't got enough about Russian propaganda, next Friday, when we get back to Tom Cruise, we're getting back to probably the biggest 80s Russian propaganda movie of all time, the Army recruitment poster that made him the star of the 80s, 1986's Top Gun.
That's in our gold donation series, so we want to thank you for being a patron, and definitely thanks to Clark for picking another movie for us to review, and he said he's chewing over what his next pick might be. So, Clark, I hope you enjoyed this review, and I do appreciate you giving us a chance to cover it for our patrons like this, you know? There are films that feel like required discussion points if you're going to be reviewing films, and we've gotten to do a lot of them thanks to our patrons, Apocalypse Now being another big one.
Yeah, we're going to do it next month. Someone has asked us to go back to Kubrick again, sort of. We're going to go to 2001, not the movie, we already did that one, but the year 2001, Kubrick was dead, and Spielberg was completing his vision of artificial intelligence. And when you join us in May, that's the movie we're going to do.
So thank you for your support of our show. We'll talk to you soon. And until next time, don't forget to say your prayers.
Well, Andre, I happen to believe in a life after this one. I know I'll have to answer what I've done. And I think I can.
Yes, well, of course you can. Of course you can.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Major Kong, is it possible this is some kind of loyalty test?
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
You just start your countdown, and old Bucky will be back here before you can say, blast off!
And we want to wish a special thank you to Clark Fisher for his tremendous support of our show and for picking Dr. Strangelove for this patron-exclusive review.
I'm not a sentimentalist of all nature, but I think I know what's in every heart in this room. I think we ought to all just bow our heads and give a short prayer of thanks.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
That is precisely the idea, General. That is precisely the idea.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
He had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing.
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
They have neither the time, the training, nor the inclination for strategic thought.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
You recognize my voice, Rick?
I do, sir. Why do you ask?
You don't think I'd ask if you recognized my voice unless it was pretty damned important, do you, Mandrake?
No, I don't, sir, no.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
We are rapidly approaching a moment of truth both for ourselves as human beings and for the life of our nation. Now, truth is not always a pleasant thing.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
I shouldn't tell you this, Mandrake, but you're a good officer and you have a right to know.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
We don't want to start a nuclear war unless we really have to, do we?
Are you certain of that, Mandrake?
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I would say, sir, that there was something dreadfully wrong somewhere.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Well, look, baby, I can't talk to you now, but my president needs me.
We'll meet again. Don't go away.
The blueprints for the B-52 bombers, all of this stuff, it's not fiction. He researched it extensively, and a lot of what you're seeing is nonfiction.
The sad thing is, every single time we mention B-52s on this show, I will hear a different song going through my head. Right now, it's Rock Lobster.
Okay. I was going to ask you, Love Shack or Rock Lobster?
Well, I also like Big Bird.